night after night, month after month, our bomber squadrons travel far into Germany and inflict shattering blows.
This is the music they play every night in London, the Symphony of War.
All you could see was a squadron of Hurricanes, a squadron of Spitfires. The morale of the fighter pilots leapt up when we realized we were still in command of the sky.
The sign of a great fighter in the ring is, can he get up from the floor after being knocked down? London does this every morning.
Inside the Battle of Britain, from the Royal Air Force Benevolent Fund. It's early September 1940. The Luftwaffe have been sending their bombers and fighters over Great Britain in ever greater numbers. However, they failed to break the RAF within 2 weeks, as their commander-in-chief, Reichs Marshal Hermann Göring, had promised. The Nazi leadership decide to change tactics. Instead of targeting air bases and radar stations, the Luftwaffe attack British cities, industry and ports. They mean to destroy British morale and bring the country to the negotiating table. This is the start of the Blitz. I'm Victoria Taylor, a military historian specialising in British and German aviation. In this episode, we'll hear about the devastating experience of the Blitz bombings for British civilians and how Fighter Command and Bomber Command were fighting back. Episode 4, The Blitz. It's almost 2 months into the Battle of Britain, and the fighting has been a hard and bloody struggle. The German attempt to land a knockout blow in August against the RAF has failed, but as the author and historian Steve Darlow explains, Hermann Göring thinks they're about to win.
Fighter Command is not defeated. Attrition rates are high, but it's not defeated. At the beginning of September, Göring tells his commanders, we are now on the brink of victory. He claims that the RAF is down to less than 100 fighters. It isn't. Göring believes that London is unprotected. It isn't.
On the 1st of September, the Nazi propaganda magazine Deutsche Luftwacht, or German Air Watch, writes, all of these attacks by the German Luftwaffe are just the beginning. Just the first probing of the enclosed fortress of England. Just the start of a hellish concert that precedes the downfall. They think it's the beginning of the end for Britain. But what the Germans don't know is that their intelligence is wrong, and that this change of tactics, although it will cost tens of thousands of British lives, may well cost Germany victory in the Battle of Britain. The Blitz also begins as retaliation by the Germans. After the Germans accidentally bomb London during a raid in late August, Winston Churchill orders Bomber Command to strike back at Berlin. Although they didn't cause much damage, the presence of British bombers over the Reich infuriated Adolf Hitler. On the 4th of September, he makes a speech threatening overwhelming revenge. Hitler says, if the British Air Force drops 2, 3, or 4,000 kilos of bombs, then we will drop 150,000, 180,000, 230,000, 300,000, or 400,000 kilos or more in one night. If they declare that they will attack our cities on a large scale, we will erase theirs.
The main focus now is on a continuous nighttime assault to maintain a political and a military pressure, the Blitz. First phase of that, starting in September, is the attack on London. Then in November, you have the blitzing of Coventry and a focus on the industry and ports. The purpose of the Blitz, the Luftwaffe is looking to break Britain's resolve and bring it to the negotiating table. And there is a considerable amount of damage caused. 43,000 civilians are killed, estimates of 139,000 are wounded, 2 million houses, over half of those are in London.
On the 7th of September 1940, known as Black Saturday by the British, the bombing began in earnest. Hermann Göring had taken charge of the attack himself. It targeted London's docks and warehouses, inflicting enormous damage. 25,000 auxiliary firefighters were needed to help the fire brigade to put out the blazes. Göring was delighted and told his wife London was in flames. The British issued code word Cromwell, the code word indicating that invasion was imminent.
Jerry's a little bit late tonight.
That night, more than 300 civilians lost their lives and over 1,000 were seriously injured.
That was a bomb.
From then on, the attacks came day and night. Between mid-September and mid-November, German bombers attacked London every night but one. The blackout was imposed. People had to turn out or conceal any external light after dark in an attempt to hide targets from the bombers. Films like London Can Take It reported the damage for American audiences, but presented a defiant face.
The sign of a great fighter in the ring is, can he get up from the floor after being knocked down? London does this every morning.
London was certainly not the only target, as Charlotte Tomlinson, an historian who specializes in the experience and legacies of Britain during the Second World War, explains.
So the thing for me that really sets the Blitz apart from other periods of bombing is the intensity in terms of the amount of bombs, the amount of bombing, this relentlessness, the scale of the bombing. For example, in London, there are 57 days and nights of consecutive bombing at the start of the Blitz. There are hundreds of thousands of tons of explosives and other bombs dropped. We often think of the Blitz happening in London and particularly in East London. And usually if we think beyond that, we think of Liverpool or we think of Coventry. But actually the Blitz was really widespread. So you have bombing in other cities like Bristol, Manchester, Belfast, Clydebank in Scotland, in Cardiff, in Hull, in Sheffield. And these places are targeted because they're port towns that are really important, because they're industrial centres. But I think one thing we miss about the Blitz is that the Blitz is really felt everywhere in Britain. So you might live in a small town or village surrounding a city. You might live in a rural area where evacuees are coming from urban areas. You see the Blitz on newsreels, you see them in the cinema, you hear about it on the radio, in the newspaper. And you know people who live in Blitz areas or close to Blitz areas. So the Blitz really is everywhere.
Bomb shelters were distributed and built in people's homes, gardens, and in the streets. Additionally, millions of children and mothers with young children, pregnant women, and vulnerable people were evacuated out of the areas that were expected to be bombed. Known as Operation Pied Piper, the government moved about 3 million people across England, with around another 10,000 transported to Australia, Canada, and the USA.
We have air raid shelters erected, perhaps private ones in people's gardens, but also communal ones in streets and in public spaces that are deemed suitable. One of the biggest things that people do is that hundreds of thousands of volunteers are mobilised to help deal with the impact and the aftermath of raids. And of course, we have things that are really well known, such as gas masks being distributed or blackouts being introduced.
Eight Hurricanes of No. 504 Squadron left Hendon at 1405 hours. Soon after 1430 hours, they met near Gravesend, about 20 Dornier 215s, three or four Vics, flying towards London at about 19,000 feet, well escorted in all directions by Messerschmitt 109s, which did not, however, attack our enemy aircraft. Two sections of No. 504 Squadron attacked the Dorniers, bomber formation broke up. One Dornier 215 was destroyed by Pilot Officer Hardacre. A formation of about 35 Heinkel 111s was also seen some way behind. The first bomber formation flying towards London at about 20,000 feet in Vicks of 3. The whole formation a large wedge.
While the intensity of the Blitz and its horrifying impact on civilians was all too clear, Fighter Command pilots were far from being down to their last few aircraft, as Hermann Göring believed. Spitfires and Hurricanes were up in the air defending Britain against the bombers, with Bristol Blenheims, Baltimore Defiance and Bristol Beaufighters particularly shifting into night fighter roles. The combat reports written at the time, and read first by pilots serving with the RAF aerobatic team, the Red Arrows, describe encounter after encounter with large formations of German bombers, accompanied by their fighter escorts.
At about 12:10 hours over London, south of the Thames, they met a formation of 20 or more Dornier 215s, flying northwest at 20,000 feet. About 20 Messerschmitt 109s were in the vicinity. Number 504 Squadron attacked, about 70 Hurricanes and Spitfires joined the battle. Pilot Officer White followed a lame duck and shot it down near Tunbridge Wells. High-level bombing over London was noticed.
Although the Germans believed the Blitz would win the battle, their shift away from attacking air bases and radar stations actually worked in the RAF's favour. As Steve Darlow explains, Air Chief Marshal Hugh Dowding and Air Vice Marshal Keith Park used it to their advantage.
The RAF now has got some breathing space and it can recover to some extent and can still mount considerable opposition. So in September 1940, the Luftwaffe's change of tactic from attacking the airfields, attacking the Royal Air Force directly, to bombing the cities has now proved that it was a real tactical error and very significant to defeating the Luftwaffe in the Battle of Britain. And Park and Dowding, they were able to capitalise on this change. They could get more experience for their pilots, they could get more training for their pilots, they could get more aircraft available for the squadrons. Nevertheless, at the time, it did still result in the imminent invasion warnings and the threat was perceived as severe.
The strain was immense. With increasing nightly raids, fighter pilots had to learn to defend in the dark, without the visual aid of sunlight in the daytime. Maintaining morale in the face of devastation on the ground was also a huge challenge, as squadron leader Tony Pickering of 501 Squadron remembers.
We did feel a bit wary at times because we were doing 3-4 trips a day, and round about the end of September, on a Saturday night, the Air Vice Marshal Park, he must have decided to put a lot of aircraft into the air, and he flew us up and down the railway line between Ashford and Croydon, and we were patrolling that line. And we flew up and down, and all you could see was a squadron of Hurricanes, a squadron of Spitfires. I don't think Park ever realised it, but the morale of the fighter pilots leapt up when we realised we were still in command of the sky.
For civilians on the ground, the bombings utterly changed their lives. Fred Hammond was 15 years old and living in West Ham with his father at the time of the Blitz. He avoided evacuation to help care for his terminally ill mother, and every evening they would head down to the Anderson shelter built in their garden. He says, "You could hear the bombs coming down. I can remember the bombing was going on, and we heard this bomb was coming, and my father said to me, 'This one is going to be close,' and it dropped somewhere about 30 yards away from us. We were safe. We were not injured. We took it in our stride and just went on."
Unsurprisingly, the impact on civilians was pretty huge. You might lose your house, you might lose your friends and your family, you might lose your own life. And with that comes all of this emotional, mental impact as well, that you're living under bombardment or anticipating that you might be bombed for really long periods of time. We have the benefit of hindsight now, that Britain would win the war, but that wasn't the case then. so it's really emotionally testing.
Nearly 2 million people volunteered to work in civil defence, as air raid wardens, firefighters, rescue workers, and in other roles. And the Women's Voluntary Service, or WVS, recruited 1 million women to support those who had been bombed.
Women might become air raid wardens, but these women also run rest centres where after raids, if you've been bombed out of your house, you find somewhere to seek shelter, somewhere to sleep for the night, somewhere to get a change of clothing, somewhere to get a hot meal, and just to have some comfort, a cup of tea, and to know you're looked after when potentially everything in your life is suddenly gone. The women also run mobile canteens to provide refreshments to firefighters, rescue workers, those out in the Blitz. And they also operate inquiry points where people can get information. So if their loved ones are missing, they can try and find out if they've been registered somewhere or if their house is damaged beyond repair or they can't live in it for a while, they'll find information about where they should go, where they should live. And this work is really, really important.
Meanwhile, across the Channel, Germany was assembling a fleet of invasion barges ready for the launch of Operation Sea Lion, the invasion of Britain. It was the job of the RAF's Bomber Command and Coastal Command to stop them. Both branches flew bombing raids during the battle. Coastal Command to attack the fleet and to protect Allied convoys and shipping, and Bomber Command to venture further into enemy territory. They did this while Fighter Command fought the defensive battle over Britain's cities and ports. Steve Darlow again.
So during the period of the Battle of Britain, it's not just Germany bombing England. The Royal Air Force, particularly Bomber Command, is bombing German targets in occupied territory as well. Bomber Command is taking this offensive posture. Fighter Command, though, it has that defensive role. It's the Spitfires and the Hurricanes. They mustn't be relinquishing the air superiority over England. But Bomber Command, it's got this offensive attitude and it's proving to the Germans the importance of air superiority if they want to invade. And of course, by doing so, it's maintaining the RAF as a threat to any cross-channel invasion. It's going to be risky. And actually most notable in this period is the campaign against the build-up of German invasion barges in the Channel ports. And that's probably its most effective contribution during that Battle of Britain period.
In August alone, Bomber Command flew 2,227 sorties across Germany and occupied Europe. By September, it was beginning to reach 200 sorties some nights, with its bombers bringing the fight to German cities, aerodromes, aircraft factories, ports, and invasion barges. Like their Luftwaffe counterparts, Bomber Command's full impact in the Battle of Britain was often stunted by its ageing bombers, a lack of precision bombing, and unreliable navigational aids. Its air crews also had to contend with bad weather, the threat of German interceptors, and enemy flak. Bomber Command suffered the heaviest losses of all RAF branches in the Battle of Britain, with 718 people killed. By the end of the war, more than 55,000 airmen in Bomber Command had lost their lives, a death rate of almost 45%. This was testimony to the immense dangers and hazardous nature of fighting the bombing war. Nevertheless, its importance to public morale, to give Britain a sense that it was striking back against the Germans, was enormous. In his speech to Parliament on the 20th of August 1940, just before the Blitz began, Winston Churchill claimed British bombers were having great success in their raids on Germany. He recorded his speech later for broadcast.
All our hearts go out to the fighter pilots, whose brilliant actions we see with our own eyes day after day. But we must never forget that all the time, night after night, month after month, our bomber squadrons travel far into Germany, find their targets in the darkness by the highest navigational skill, aim their attacks, often under the heaviest fire, often with serious loss, with deliberate careful discrimination, and inflict shattering blows upon the whole of the technical and war-making structure of the Nazi power.
On the home front, people needed all the morale boosting they could muster in the face of the damage inflicted by Luftwaffe bombers, despite Fighter Command's defence. Britain's grim determination to press on with the war has entered national mythology as the Blitz spirit. As Charlotte Tomlinson explains, it remains deeply embedded within the British psyche today.
When we talk about the Blitz spirit today, and we do a lot, we're talking about this idea that during the Blitz, the British people were brave. They were stoic. They applied grit and good humour to get through bombing. They were optimistic. They didn't really doubt that victory would come eventually. They were unified and together, and above all, they were resilient, more than anything else.
A heavy incendiary bombing raid has occurred in the city area. Many large fires are in progress and rapidly spreading. All available appliances have been ordered out.
It has very real roots in the war itself, in propaganda, in popular culture, in people's stories and experiences of the war. But the bigger picture is more nuanced, more complex. There was a Blitz spirit in that the morale of the British people wasn't broken. It didn't take Britain to the negotiating table. It didn't take Britain to defeat. But of course, this is a war.
These grim scenes, reminiscent of the Great Fire of London nearly three centuries ago, were taken from the roof of St. Paul's. They embraced the area from St. Paul's Churchyard to Newgate Street.
It's a war that comes with all the horrors and difficulties that any war does.
In fighting the fires, 16 firemen were killed, 11 by high explosive bombs and 5 by falling walls.
So there are massive amounts of loss, of grief, of fear. Just as at any other time, there's division, there's criticism of the government. And we think of the Blitz spirit as everyone being together, putting aside their differences and just getting on with it for the greater good. But for example, there are really significant amounts of anti-Semitism at this time. There's crime, there's grumbling, there's all of those kind of things that complicate. They don't mean that the Blitz spirit didn't happen, that it doesn't have roots in reality. But I think it's more useful for us to think of it as that idea, as one way of looking at the Blitz, rather than a representative, singular sort of way of looking at it.
The Blitz spirit may not have been as unshakable as it's now remembered, and it was heavily tested. The intensive Blitz bombings continued until May 1941, months after the threat of an imminent German invasion had passed. But along with Fighter Command's defence of British skies and Bomber Command's attacks against Germany, this public resolve was crucial to keeping British morale from breaking under the Luftwaffe's bombs. In the next episode, victory.
There in front is a German. Slowly and relentlessly, we're overhauling him.
Already one of his engines is on fire.
There were still nearly 5 more years of fighting left in the Second World War. So what did it mean for Britain to have won this battle? We'll hear from more of those in the air and on the ground who helped Britain live to fight another day. This series is a Royal Air Force Benevolent Fund production made by Chalk and Blade. It is co-written and presented by me, Victoria Taylor. The producer is Eva Krizyak. The mix and theme music are by Alex Portfelix, and the executive producers are Laura Sheeta and Logan Armandoni. The recording with Tony Pickering is courtesy of Steve Darlow. Original audio clips are courtesy of the BFI National Film Archive and Film London, London Screen Archives. The combat report extracts, which are held at the National Archives, were read by Red One Squadron Leader Martin Pert from the RAF aerobatic team, the Red Arrows. The historical consultant is Stuart Hadaway at the Royal Air Force Air Historical Branch.
This podcast is brought to you by the Royal Air Force Benevolent Fund, the RAF's leading welfare charity. We are there for all members of the RAF family in their time of need. From those serving today,
to former members of the RAF, as well as their partners and dependent children. If you know of someone who might need some support, or to find out more, please visit our website, rafbf.org.